The following day, they were in Cook's travel agency in Mayfair.
Come on, my dear Dotty, humour this old gal. The change of scenery will do you good.
Dotty lit a hangover cigarette and coughed. And with that, their mini-break was agreed. Train from Calais, change for the Gotthard Bahn and a journey through the Alps. 3 days in Florence, 3 in Rome, and a flight back to London Airport. What could be nicer? The cash register sang. That night, a phone call. Evelyn climbed out of bed. I'm taking my easel, said Dotty. Dotty was on the mend, thought Evelyn. How exciting, she said. Just charcoals and pencils, back to basics. What do you think?
Marvellous idea.
You don't mind? I would have suggested it had I thought you had listened to me. Throaty laughed down the receiver.
Dotty, it's all still there, you know. Who you were when you painted me.
Thanks, darling.
Sleep now.
Evelyn replaced the receiver. She was wide awake again. She got back into bed and drank a glass of water. She picked up Eleanor Clark's Rome and a Villa. She read it whilst listening to rain on the window. 5 days later, Evelyn and Dotty set out for Europe, the most unlikely-looking pair, one sporting the workwear of a trawlerman, the other in a white cape and turban. They boarded the ferry at Folkestone and enjoyed a calm crossing of blue sky and blue water and white cresting gulls. In Paris, they changed from the Gare du Nord to the Gare du Lion, taking a taxi on account of the easel, and then settled at a neighbourhood bistro that Evelyn had known during wartime. Jules was within walking distance of the station and quite popular with wealthy families heading south. A robust wine list was its backbone, and no one got on the Pullman sleeper wide awake. The 3-hour stopover went by quickly. Late sunshine turned to dusk and eventually night, as platters of coquille Saint-Jacques and oysters were lustily devoured with a crisp house wine that Dotty swore was poulet fumé. As Dotty swallowed the last of the bivalve, she said, Margaret, someone. And Evelyn said, Oh, Lord, what about her? Do you ever see her?
No. Never, thank goodness, said Evelyn. Not since the debacle in Florence. What on earth made you think of her?
Don't turn round, but there's a woman behind you who looks remarkably like her.
I said, don't turn round. Oh, my giddy, giddy God. Look who it is,
screeched Margaret someone across the terrace, a sound that made the French hate the English a little more. Evelyn's smile turned rictus. You look like you've had a stroke, said Dotty.
Maybe I'm having one, whispered Evelyn.
Margaret pulled out a chair and leant across the table clumsily, putting the carafe of wine in peril. At times like these, Dotty's reflexes were razor sharp. Margaret said,
Evelyn Skinner, how long has it been? 10 years? You don't look a day older. You know, Dotty, don't you?
Said Evelyn, as if she'd just learned to speak.
Oh, yes. Still up to old tricks?
Well, you know what they say about old dogs.
Naughty you for not contacting me after Florence, said Margaret, turning back to Evelyn. But I'm not one to hold a grudge. You're not heading back there, are you?
Oh, no, said Evelyn and Dotty in unison. No, no, no.
Well, I'm on my way back from a little tour, said Margaret. Had a splendid time at the Verrocchio exhibition, don't you know? I've been travelling with a new...
pause.
Friend.
And she turned to her table and smiled at a sweet blonde demure lamb. The word slaughter came to Evelyn's mind.
What?
Said Margaret.
What?
Said Evelyn.
You said slaughter, said Margaret.
I did?
Yes, you did.
Oh, I meant that's not Meredith Slaughter, is it?
No, no, Myrtle Forbright. We share a love of ornithology. Who's Meredith Slaughter?
I don't know, said Evelyn.
But you just mentioned her.
Evelyn thinks she's having a stroke, said Dotty, nudging Evelyn under the table.
Really?
Said Margaret. Evelyn nodded.
Isn't that serious?
Said Margaret. Not if it's a small one, said Dotty, finishing her glass of wine and lighting a cigarette.
Should we do something?
Said Margaret. Probably, said Dotty, blowing out a long plume of smoke. She turned to Evelyn and held the cigarette tantalizingly within reach.
Can you...
she said. And Evelyn stretched out her arm, took the cigarette, and inhaled. She's going to be fine, said Dotty.
Phew, said Margaret. Where were we?
Well, I'm not sure where you were, said Dotty, looking at her watch. But we've got a train to catch. Cheerio, Margaret. Safe travels home. On the dot of nine, the train inched through the dark and left the lights of Paris heading towards Switzerland. In the sleeper, Dotty climbed the ladder to the upper bunk and slid around in her silk pajamas. Evelyn checked her bed for fleas and was glad not to find anything with more legs than her. She poured out two measures of brandy before lights out.
And Margaret, someone, said Dotty.
What on earth were you thinking? She said, turning the focus on Evelyn and her less than successful affairs for a change.
I wasn't, said Evelyn. We met not long after Gabriella died. At a dull soiree of muscadet and attribution. I was incredibly limp that night, and Margaret was... she was... well, she was...
A caliper, said Dotty.
Yes, 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 that's the word. And she was rather vigorous in her lovemaking. It sort of woke me up.
Literally?
Metaphorically? A little of both, I think. I was in grief.
I know you were.
Such a long time ago now.
She used to buy me long-lasting flowers.
Carnations?
Yes. Well, let that be a lesson. Night, darling. See you in Switz. Sleep came fast to Evelyn, and brought with it not a dream but a vivid memory to the pillow, a dinner with her father at Quo Vadis. The atmosphere was as convivial as ever, despite a radical shift from father-daughter relations after his mistress muse, Gabriella Cortez, had formed a passionate attachment to Evelyn. Evelyn was as willing and enthusiastic as ever in this new alliance. She had never been so happy. Father and daughter toasted one another, and at the end of the dinner, Evelyn handed her father a letter that she'd written in Florence 25 years before. She couldn't explain why he was receiving it only then. She had mislaid it, and they had mislaid one another many times across the years. It was about love. He read it there and then. He was silent and thoughtful. He reached out and kissed his daughter's hand, and nothing more was said. The next day he drove her to Gabriella's small flat with her bags. You have my blessing, H.W. said, but please, two conditions. The first, she said, that you do not discuss me the man, only the painter. She rolled her eyes and laughed. And secondly, that I paint you both. Not in flagrante delicto, she said sternly. Post, he said. Conditions were met, and the painting was highly celebrated and bought by the National Gallery after a generous bequest by a dead lord somebody or other. Evelyn and Gabriella were together for 10 years. They lived in a well-decorated nest on the edge of Bloomsbury, where Evelyn still resided. In 1937, Gabriella Cortez died fighting Franco. She would be Evelyn's last great love. Not long after the funeral, one weekend in May, Evelyn stood in front of the painting in a busy National Gallery and wept. Dotty was by her side. In the middle of the night, Evelyn awoke, aware that the train was stationary. She peeked from behind the blind and followed a lantern moving along the platform until two men found each other. She thought them to be the watchmen. She couldn't recognize the town they were in, much of a muchness, small stations at night, but that was half the thrill. The room felt chill all of a sudden, and she pulled the blanket up high and wrapped Dotty's jumper around her head, settled into the comfortable sound of her friend's deep slumber. She knew when she next woke up, Switzerland would be pressing itself against the window. The train kept to schedule, and as predicted, crossed the border at 6 o'clock the following morning. Crisp mountain air commingled with the smell of coffee and eggs and...
Is that sausage?
Asked Evelyn from the lower bunk. Definitely porky, said Dotty. And propelled by years of lack, the two women were up, washed and dressed by the time the next round of meat hit the sizzling, blackened pan. The ever-changing sight of mountains and ravines and meadows stunned them, pulled them into an interiority they would later share, in Florence perhaps, or Rome. Silenced by the magnificent Alps, by the feat of engineering that cut through the Gotthard Pass, Dotty retreated to an empty corner of the carriage with a sketchbook and charcoals, and the hours fell away in a series of carefully sculpted lines and shading, of abstract versions of rock formations or sharp drops, the microscopic detail often appearing as a face or shell in the mastery of her craft. Evelyn let her mind drift, fizzing as it was with fact and fiction, because she knew the journey so well, could anticipate every incline and shift in speed before it happened. The train clattered and entered the Gotthard Tunnel. Evelyn closed her eyes and met the dark with dark. At what she imagined to be the midpoint, the name of Louis Favre came back to mind, the man whose company had begun the 9-mile-long tunnel back in 1872, 8 years before her birth. Two crews had bored and blasted into the rock from opposite sides of the mountain, intending to meet 4.5 miles underneath. And when they did eventually meet, were found to be only 13 inches off. Favre was 4 months dead by then. Stress and bankruptcy had killed him. But at the point of connection, a canister that held his image was passed through the gap, a promise fulfilled that he would be the first person ever to have passed through the tunnel. Evelyn was still subsumed by the keen brilliance of it all when a lurch and a clatter shook her, and sunlight fell upon her eyelids again. The train was through the tunnel. She brushed away the light dusting of smuts from her dark jumper and turned back and waved to Dotty. She opened a bottle of Evian water and drank. How excited she felt. How invigorated. Adventure, the best medicine. At approximately 5 that afternoon, the train arrived at Santa Maria Novella station. Evelyn was one of the first onto the platform and exclaimed, as she always did, Firenze, amore mio. And the city, of course, answered her with bells. By 5:15 p.m, the women were in a taxi heading to the demure charms of the Pensione Picci, a small guesthouse along the Lungarno Corsini. And by 5:45 p.m, they had checked into their twin room with a view, with newly installed ensuite bathroom. Fancy that, said Dotty. By 6:30 p.m. they had unpacked, and by 7 p.m. they had pulled up a couple of uncomfortable wicker chairs and were watching clouds pass nonchalantly over the dome of San Frediano in Cestello, listening to the roll of trams and the whine of vespers below. They were weary from travelling, and as the sun continued its journey west, casting shadows and drawing out colours across the water, they sipped perfectly chilled spumante, offered gratis to every returning guest. Because we know you have a choice, said Enzo, the proprietor, in his gruff Florentine accent. Not at this price, said Evelyn. The next day, Evelyn woke early, flung the shutters wide and praised the light. Dotty raised her head from the pillow and said, Good God, what's that?
It's the morning, said Evelyn.
It was an unhurried start, and by the time they got downstairs, they were forced to seek breakfast elsewhere after an altercation at the buffet table involving the last boiled egg. Evelyn knew of a neighbourhood cafe in the vicinity of the Pensione Simi, although the hotel itself had long closed its doors, and with coffee beckoning, they set out along the river towards the Uffizi, and Dotty's first day of sketching. The easel was lightly balanced on Dotty's shoulder, nudging the battered Panama she'd found during a visit to the Alhambra. Evelyn carried the foldaway fisherman's stool against her chest. She kept complaining it smelt of carp. in the colonnade of the Uffizi. Dottie settled her things in the corner, beneath the statues of Galileo and Pier Antonio Micheli, whilst Evelyn went to look for a carabinieri to bribe, so Dottie's day would remain hassle-free. By the time Evelyn returned, the easel was erected and the large sketchbook placed upon it, and Dottie was looking thoroughly incognito with her Panama pulled low. She intended to give the portraits away for free. Art for art's sake, she said. An act of joy, craft, and generosity. Unsigned, obviously, though, she said.
Obviously, said Evelyn,
who scribbled an explanation of the proceedings in Italian and English to encourage the first sitters before word eventually got around about the giveaway. Evelyn left Dottie to her first portrait, a middle-aged husband and wife from Connecticut, Hank and Gwen, who had the day before suffered terribly at the hands of a caricaturist. She walked out into the sunshine, suddenly unsure what to do with the hours ahead. There was a moment's pause before she turned left. Had she turned right, however, she would have bumped into the man who had been on her mind at that very moment. For Ulysses Temper was standing in a cafe near the Ponte Vecchio, drinking an espresso, waiting for Cressy to come by on his Moto Guzzi Falcone. Evelyn crossed over the Piazza dei Giudici, where once had stood a tiratoio, one of the vast sheds in which damp wool was stretched out to dry. Evelyn never saw this lost capsule to Renaissance times, but Constance had as a child. Constance had written a poem about it, before the building was destroyed in the mid-1800s to make way for the Chamber of Commerce. The steps were still there, though, the ones that led from the tiratoio to the river, where the process of washing the wool and the rinsing and dyeing took place. The wool industry had given Florence her wealth, a quarter of the population employed in the industry at the height of its fame. The washers, the carders, the combers, the weavers, the dyers, the spinners, all paid a pittance, of course, until the great revolt of 1378. Evelyn turned left at Via de' Benci. They had been packed into a notorious slum on what was once marshy, squalid land. Right here, thought Evelyn, right where I'm walking now. Unsurprisingly, the Franciscans, one of the newly arrived mendicant orders, chose to settle there and establish a church to help the poor. And just like that, as if she was leading a walking tour, the Basilica of Santa Croce rose on her right.
What timing, she thought.
She veered across the piazza, through the parked cars, and made her way towards the statue of Dante. She always had the feeling he was pleased to see her. She found the herb shop by San Simone that sold great quantities of dried sage, and she bought a smallish bushel for Dottie, who liked to burn it in her studio to clear a path for the muse. In Piazza Sant'Ambrogio, had she had more of an appetite, she would have bought a mid-morning snack of Lampredotto. The long queues vouched for the quality. But she opted for a handful of Francesca apples instead, a tiny ancient variety with a most delicious perfume. Ate one straight away in the doorway of a workshop where she watched a man carving out the body of a violin. On leaving the area, she acquired a button for her cardigan from a beggar woman. It didn't match the other four, which were green, but it was striking. Dottie was packing up her easel when Evelyn turned the corner.
Someone looks happy, she said.
What a morning, said Dottie. 7 studies, I tell you, and a couple of them were rather good. You?
Wandering mostly, happily surprised at the speed of reconstruction. The city looks gloriously intact. I brought some postcards. Choose which ones you'd like. Oh, and this.
And Evelyn held out the bundle of sage. Dottie stopped what she was doing.
You darling, she said.
Evelyn looked about at the statues that occupied the niches and said,
the 3 corone fiorentine, the 3 Florentine crowns. Poets, of course. Dante here, Petrarch over there, and Boccaccio. What's odd about Dante?
Is this a trick question, Linny?
Not at all.
Go on, tell me.
Spelt his name wrong.
That's careless, said Dottie,
and the laurels about his head.
Was he never a poet laureate?
No. Boccaccio would have had him as one. Petrarch not,
Bastardo, said Dotty, handing the footstool to her friend. They moved on through towards the Piazza della Signoria, and Dotty said, You'll never guess who I saw. Who? Said Evelyn. Hartley Ramsden and Margot Eads.
Good Lord, did they recognize you?
No, thank goodness. Oh, and Vi Trefusis was with them, she added.
Vi? With Hartley and Margot?
Dotty nodded.
Well, I never. That's a turn-up.
Talking some piffle-wiffle about Cimabue's crucifix. Had I not been concentrating on the magnificent profile of the young woman from Norwich, I might have launched myself into the river. Lunch was at a table overlooking the Loggia dei Lanzi and Palazzo Vecchio, and consisted of a first-rate spaghetti ai carciofi, followed by tripe and potatoes and a carafe of red wine, then gelati, chocolate and crema, finished with the requisite espresso. Evelyn turned her attention to the table. How the sun had cast its light and forced shadow across the debris of lunch. The jug of wine, the ashtray, the cigarette nubs with their faint ring of red lipstick. The vase of wisteria clusters, the sticky tide mark around the espresso cups. The image muted by the haze of dust falling from the makeshift trellis. A story of lunch, yes, but also a story of them. They were the last to leave. Evelyn placed a few notes on the saucer and stood up.
Andiamo, cara.
Oh, let's not go, said Dotty. It'll be cocktail hour soon.
All the more reason, said Evelyn. Come on, Dotty. Up, up, up.
Dotty picked up her easel and knocked over a couple of flower arrangements as she left.
Keep walking, said Evelyn. I left a nice tip.
They hadn't got far before a child stopped in front of Evelyn and screamed,
Pinocchio!
Good God, where? Said Evelyn, horrified.
He's behind you, said Dotty in pantomime mode. Evelyn turned. The shop had a display of the puppet boy in various guises. Not a fan, said Dotty as they moved away.
Not as a child, that's for certain, said Evelyn. I found him to be a maniac. And when he murdered the talking cricket, I was quite affected. For me, it was the silencing of truth, politically speaking, of course.
Of course, said Dotty,
and we know where that leads.
How old were you, darling?
9, thereabouts.
You never were a child, were you, Linny?
No, not really, Dotty. I was reading Vasari's Lives of the Artists by then.
The river came into sight. Dotty said, Sweet little film, though, right? Evelyn stopped. You didn't like it, said Dotty.
No, I didn't, said Evelyn. Pinocchio is a poor provincial Tuscan boy, and he was forced to cast off the clothes of his identity in order to wear the same white gloves as Mickey Mouse. White gloves, Dotty. Sometimes I think I'm the only one who notices these things.
That's because you are, said Dotty. And she took her friend's arm and led her west towards the pensione. Did you see how that woman back there looked at me? Said Dotty.
I did.
I've still got it.
You never lost it. I think I did. Just a bit. Not for long, though.
No. Not for long. Midnight, and they'd just turned off the light. The sound of a match being struck, and Dotty's face flared yellow in the darkness. She sat up and reached for an ashtray. She said, I wanted to ask you, Linny. Earlier, when I was waiting for you, I went to the Loggia to sketch the statues. In particular, the Giambologna.
Which one? Said Evelyn. Hercules or the rape?
The rape.
One of the greats.
Isn't it? I felt aroused.
You're supposed to.
I did wonder. But it troubled me. Evelyn said,
Giambologna knew exactly what he was doing, Dotty. He understood the erotic dance as much as he understood the response. The struggle between idealized man versus the mortal. It's as if he's watching us, looking at it. It's quite a bravura performance, really. But context is everything, and the long, heavy hand of religion was everywhere. This statue, more than anything, represents the artistic freedom of the Renaissance, the freedom to think and feel outside of the church. It was only with the recuperation of the great classical tradition, subjects of classical antiquity, that artists could free themselves from the constraints of Christianity and so present narratives of good and evil, bloody and exalting, thrilling and, yes, arousing.
Dottie handed the cigarette across the darkness to Evelyn. The tip glowed orange. Evelyn said,
I think it's also worth noting at this point that without Giambologna, Bernini wouldn't have been Bernini.
Wouldn't he?
No, and then where would we have been?
Where indeed, said Dottie. Is there nothing you don't know, Linny?
Oh, plenty, said Evelyn, stubbing out the cigarette. I don't know much about motor racing.
Not such a loss, though, said Dottie. Night-night, sweets. The next morning, the two women were up early. Dottie jettisoned the easel that day for a more mobile life with footstool and large drawing pad. They pocketed the last two boiled eggs on their way out and took coffee in Via dei Neri at a bustling cafe full of stylish young men and women. Evelyn couldn't decide whether or not to go over to the Piazza del Carmine to see the Masaccio frescoes, but chose not to in the end. Had she listened to that quiet nudge inside her, that impulse to go south, she would have crossed into Piazza Santo Spirito at the same time as Ulysses, who was on his way to his workshop. They would have stopped and looked at one another in disbelief, and she would have said,
It's you, isn't it?
And he would have said, Yeah, it's me. She would have gone towards him and embraced him. They would have been momentarily speechless at the way fate had summoned them once again. They would have walked arm in arm towards Michele's cafe and would have sat down and ordered coffee, and Ulysses, in faltering Italian, would have explained to Michele who Evelyn was, how they'd previously met, how he'd never been happier to see anyone in his life. She would have commented on his language ability, and she would finally have said,
So tell me, Ulysses, how is the good captain?
This was the version of events, had Evelyn gone south. But what she did that morning was to go and buy a newspaper, La Repubblica, from a nearby stand. She took the bus up to Fiesole. The almond trees were in blossom when she made the ascent to the convent of San Francesco. The roses were pink and fragrant in hedgerows, the view across the Magnone Valley exhilarating. She sat and read her newspaper overlooking an olive grove, but there was always the gnawing feeling that she should have been somewhere else, seeing someone else. By the time she returned to the colonnade, Dottie was sketching the portraits of two handsome older men, long-time partners, obviously. It was a stunning likeness. Four shades of pencil on tinted paper. They didn't demand a signature, and yet when they took the rolled picture from her, one bent low and whispered, We know who you are. Thank you. Evelyn took Dottie to lunch over by the Pitti Palace, at a small trattoria close to Casa Guidi, former home to the poets Browning, where they shared a bistecca. An afternoon walk in the Boboli Gardens proved a more sensible alternative to another carafe of red wine. They walked slowly up through the amphitheatre, the once-upon-a-time quarry that had supplied the stone for Signor Pitti's extraordinary palace. Up past Neptune's fountain and the terraces to the top, and there Florence revealed her splendour. Golden light, the precursor to dusk, crowned them, and they appeared exalted, happy. Evelyn sat and leant against a wall and closed her eyes, and Dottie captured her there, in that moment, in a portrait of equal tenderness and soul as the one hanging in the restaurant where the plan to visit Italy had first been devised. They bathed and slept on their return to the pensione. For an hour, Evelyn watched the linen curtains billow and fall and matched her breathing to the pulse of fabric. the sound of trams outside. The birds, a burst of laughter from below, and her thoughts were of people no longer living. And it wasn't an act of nostalgia, but one of love, of reminiscence, of the people who had made her her, the privilege and the freedom they had brought her. Beauty and gratitude entwined forever in a closely woven fabric of sympathetic names. Constance, Dotty, Thaddeus Collins, H.W., Gabriella, Livia, and of course her mother. Her mother was the knot that stopped the fraying. That's what she learnt later, and learnt it the hard way, too late to say thank you, truly. A woman whose Italian lineage was a stunning counterpoint to the pale, judgmental society she at first encountered, until the night she met H.W. Skinner, as unconventional a man as she'd ever meet, who had given his heart to countless women, gossip she really should have taken seriously, because she ended up with a husband whose artistic soul she could never own, and neither was she ever the muse. She was trapped by a form of courtly love, church-imposed, whilst her body cried out for wings. He held out a daily offering of feathers and wax, but she couldn't do it, couldn't leap, for she could only see all that she wasn't. Her currency in the end was money. She gave to others the freedom she could never take for herself. She bought her daughter that first rail ticket, a gateway into her thrilling 22nd year. Evelyn remembered the journey from the rail station to the Pensione Simi, down dark streets teeming with life and smells, and across Trecento squares where she saw statues come to life and where the bells called the medieval dead to rise. A conspiracy of beauty everywhere. The city threw aside its cloak and introduced itself to her, and she met it with eyes wide and heart thumping and open-mouthed. She stumbled clumsily from the cab into the vestibule of the hotel. She couldn't speak. It wasn't being struck dumb by beauty per se, but the acknowledgement that if such beauty existed, then so did the opposite. And in that brief moment, she'd felt the opposite. Evelyn climbed out of bed and Dotty stirred. She said, "Morning, darling." And Evelyn said, "It's still evening, Dotty." Evelyn opened the cupboard and put on a long black dress, loose-fitting with three-quarter sleeves, and reached down for her Greek-style sandals. She pinned her hair and painted her mouth a vivid orange. She stood at the window, watching the city move about in dusky elegance. The sky appeared as an ocean, the clouds as waves, and an all-pervading stillness had settled, the lowering sun an image of the rising dawn. Less elegantly, behind her, Dotty was in her underwear with her legs up against the wall. "Look at these things," said Dotty, slapping her thighs. "Who could say no?" Evelyn said, "We are approaching the time when the fly yields to the mosquito, come la mosca cede alla zanzara," and she closed the shutters, casting the room into shadow and cool. "That's rather eloquent," said Dotty. "It is Dante's Inferno." Dotty threw a glance at the clock and said, "We are actually approaching the hour when water yields to the cocktail. Come l'acqua cede alla cocktaila." And she rolled away from the wall and unexpectedly met gravity. She fell off the bed with a thump. Harry's bar was tucked behind the Palazzo Corsini. It bore no relation to the more famous Harry's Bar in Venice and had been opened the year before by a man called Enrico, known as Harry or Henry to his English-speaking friends. He attended the bar at the Hotel Excelsior during wartime and was the man who had seen Evelyn at her lowest ebb. And standing in the doorway, looking into the dark interior, Evelyn felt nervous at an encounter with her past. She needn't have. Enrico noticed her immediately and said how she hadn't changed at all, offered his hand and kissed hers ceremoniously. "How I wondered what had happened to my favourite Miss Skinner," he said, and led her and Dotty over to a corner table where they had both privacy and a view of the room. He brought them what he'd always brought Evelyn. Beachy Cletters, you are a dark horse, Linny. Chin chin, clink of glass. Evelyn told Dotty that back in 44, she'd had to wait a month before she'd been able to enter the city with the Allied military government. And when she had, she'd wept. The buildings that had once overhung the river were gone. The ancient quarter, the medieval towers, all gone. She could see straight across the river to Or San Michele and the Duomo, an uninterrupted corridor never deemed possible. What had been the heart of Dante's Florence had been reduced overnight to mountainous piles of smoking rubble, an act of destruction purely to halt the Allied advance, which of course it failed to do. There was no military justification for any of it, said Evelyn. She remembered the people stumbling about incredulous and dazed by the violence inflicted upon their gentle city. She'd gone to work immediately at the headquarters of the superintendency, which had relocated to the Palazzo Pitti. The superintendency had overseen the evacuation of the artworks in the first place, and she made notes of works found, works looted, works damaged. She began the repatriation of statues and paintings to their sacred ground. Occasionally, she collaborated with the art historian Berenson and his cabal, but mostly she kept to herself. By then, something had happened to her, to her soul. She had been eroded by war, an all-consuming weariness she could find no way back from. Nights were spent quietly drinking in the Hotel Excelsior, watched over by Enrico, who knew when to bring her another drink, long before she knew she needed one herself. Dotty lit them both a cigarette and said, "That soldier you met, Ulysses?"
"Yes."
"What was it about him?" Evelyn thought for a moment.
"I don't know. I've often asked myself that. His kindness, the scar on his lip, his eyebrows, his smile."
"You sound a little in love, my darling."
"Hold that thought," said Evelyn, and she raised her glass and drank. She said, "2 years after Gabriella died, I was in Rome looking after Aunt Maria. When Maria died, it was as if Gabby had died all over again. Ulysses' enthusiasm for life was a panacea. His optimism, his surety that he wasn't going to die, as if everything that mattered to him he'd somehow protected from war. How was that possible? He was invincible, Dotty. Marvellously so. I wasn't. I had escaped Margaret and was waiting on the roadside for what? Death, I think. A way out, no matter how permanent. And then along came life. That priceless, life-affirming moment with a Renaissance masterpiece would have been nothing without him and the good captain. It was about the complete moment. Was I in love with him? Maybe a little. When the bombs fell overhead and he held my hands and shouted against the tumult, 'Not today, Evelyn, it's not going to be us today.' His faith was compelling, Dotty. I was young again. I felt young again. I will be forever grateful." "You could look for him," said Dotty. "Why on earth would he remember an old woman like me?"
"Because you're unforgettable, Evelyn Skinner." The following day brought departure. Dotty sketched across the morning and was thoroughly worn out by 12, so came back to the pensione for a nap. Evelyn left Dotty asleep in the room with a note on the dressing table, weighted down by an apple. Evelyn had packed and wanted one last look at the city before the train journey down towards the sprawl of Rome and its raucous heart. She walked out into the glinting light and slid her sunglasses onto her face. She wasn't quick to her destination, sidetracked, as always, by trails of wisteria cascading over the walls of private villas or the shy splendour of a magnolia tree on the verge of blossoming. Art and life intertwined. The predominance of blue-mow flowers in and around the city astonished her. A compelling stream from February to May, violets, wisteria, iris, not forgetting the summer cornflower, which had often been a noble bed for her and a her in some secluded meadow, in some secluded decade. The blue against a burnt umber or ochre wall, the blue against lush grass, against a white linen shirt unbuttoned and splayed, a blue of such staggering intensity, the memory too easy to find in the opaque past, flesh and love always next to blue. Such a precocious display of spring. Evelyn knew where she was going, had always known where she would end up the moment the trip had been planned, the two soldiers never far from her thoughts. She wondered at times if they were alive or dead, and always settled them firmly in life. The other was unthinkable. In the cool dark of the church, frankincense pricked her nose, and her skin reacted to the fall in temperature. On her right, the Capponi Chapel and the painting that undid the years. The faces of the two men by her side, Darnley saying, "Ulysses Temper, Miss Evelyn Skinner, I'd like you to meet Pontormo's deposition from..."
"Do you want to go in?"
Evelyn turned, surprised by the question delivered to her in English. Behind her stood a girl wearing a railway man's cap. 9, 10 maybe? Dark hair, high fringe, and a sweet, intense face full of questioning. Her sunglasses were hooked in the neck of her T-shirt, and she was holding a scroll of tinted paper that looked ever so familiar to Evelyn.
"How did you know I was English?" said Evelyn.
"Because you didn't cross yourself when you came in," said the girl.
"Oh, well spotted."
"So what do you say? I have a key."
"How fortuitous," said Evelyn. "And do you also have a name?"
"Sometimes Kid, sometimes Alice. You?"
"Always Evelyn."
Alice looked about before unlocking the gate.
"Come on then," she said. "Stick close."
And Evelyn did as she was told. She went towards the painting and closed her eyes.
"You're not even looking at it," said Alice.
"No, I'm smelling it," said Evelyn. "The olfactory bulb passes scent close to the amygdala and hippocampus, both areas in the brain that deal with emotion and memory."
"I didn't know that," said Alice.
Evelyn stepped back from the painting and said,
"Do you come here often, gatekeeper?"
"Sometimes. You?"
"Not often, no. I last saw this painting during the war."
"Which one?"
"Touché, kid," said Evelyn.
"I was born at the end of the war."
"That war, then. That's when I saw it. Not here, though," she added.
"Not that long ago, then?"
"No, not that long ago." "And what do you have there?" said Evelyn, knowing full well what the roll of paper would reveal.
"A picture. I had it done this morning."
And Alice unrolled the portrait and held it up next to her face.
"It's me," she said.
"Oh, there's no doubt about that."
And then Evelyn noticed it. In the right-hand corner, a signature. But Dottie's real signature. She had given the child a valuable gift.
"I made her sign it," said Alice. "She wasn't going to, and then she did. It might not be her real name."
"Oh, I'm sure it is."
"Do you think it's worth anything?"
"Oh, yes."
"A lot?"
"Best keep it safe."
"I'll have it framed then."
"That's the spirit," said Evelyn, and she looked down at her watch.
"Do you have to be somewhere, Evelyn?"
"I do. I have a date with Rome."
"Now?"
"In a while."
"I'll lock up then,"
said Alice, and she pulled the gate to and locked it. She placed the key on the edge of the font.
"I like the cloud," said the kid.
Evelyn stopped.
"That cloud."
And the kid pointed back to the painting.
"Do you?" said Evelyn. I knew someone who liked the cloud too once.
And she looked at the child for a resemblance to the soldier from her past. She brushed the thought from her head, couldn't be. And she opened the heavy wooden door and stepped out into the sunlight. She put on her sunglasses and the kid did the same. They walked towards the Ponte Vecchio stride for stride, and Evelyn said how much she liked the kid's cab.
I got it after seeing Fellini's I Vitelloni.
And did you enjoy the film?
Yes, I did. A nice change from neorealism.
Had enough of it?
It did what it needed to do.
And what was that?
Change the rules of filmmaking forever? I think Bicycle Thieves will be known as one of the great films, said Alice.
I think you might be right, said Evelyn.
That end sequence in I Vitelloni, you know, when Moraldo's on the train and the camera moves through his friend's bedrooms. It's how it is, isn't it, saying goodbye? All the people you leave.
Have you had to say goodbye?
Just the once.
They were separated momentarily by a dawdling group of tourists on the bridge, and Alice had to run around them to catch up. She said,
Do you know a lot, Evelyn?
A fair amount.
You look like you do.
That'll be the white turban.
Why are all the statues men?
Evelyn laughed.
Ah, yes. That is problematic. Short or long answer?
When's your train?
Fair point. Short, then. Because men sculpted them, cast them, forged them. Renaissance Italy was a world of men and a world for men. A world that advocated the inferiority of women.
Gosh.
Gosh, indeed.
Evelyn stopped at the midpoint of the bridge.
Come here, she said.
Kid went towards her and looked out across the river towards the dark hills. Evelyn pointed.
There, the Biblioteca, a showcase for men. There, the Palazzo Vecchio, showcase for men. There, the Institute of the History of Science, a showcase for men. Over there, the Uffizi Gallery, a showcase for men. History has erased the unseen, said Evelyn, and we will never know the contribution women made to that unique time.
Where were they then?
Said Kid.
Evelyn looked down at her young pupil.
How old are you? She said.
Nearly nine, but they say I have an old head on young shoulders.
Do they? Well, they say I have the opposite. Kid laughed.
You're funny, she said.
So, where were the women? Well, that depended on class. Inside mostly, if you were wealthy and married. Considerable time in the birthing room, hoping to produce male heirs. A constant succession of pregnancies from your mid-teens to your forties. You'd also be expected to run the household, of course, organizing the servants, sewing, making bread, making fires. That was a woman's life, Kid. Or the convent, the only available career for a woman. That was the choice.
You're not selling this life to me, Evelyn.
No, I'm not, am I? Evelyn laughed.
Didn't women paint as well?
They weren't allowed to. Actively forbidden from participating in the arts or sciences. Unless, of course, your father was a painter. Then you had access to materials and a workshop. But it was only the convent, really, that provided space for self-expression. Creative women from good Florentine families often found their way there for that purpose. Here's a name for you, Kid. Plautilla Nelli. She was the first female Renaissance painter and was very successful. She, in effect, ran a school for female artists. She couldn't sell her own work, but the convent could. She was a radical and defied the conventions of her time, and no one knows about her.
I do now, though.
Yes, you do now. The bridge that used to be over there? Said Evelyn, pointing.
The Ponte alle Grazie?
Well, once upon a time, it had small dwelling places and oratories attached on struts that overlooked the river. Solitary hermitages for worship. Devout nuns known as Le Murate, the walled-up ones, used to live their entire lives in tiny rooms in these buildings without ever going outside.
Never,
said the kid. Never. And they prayed for the city, and their food was delivered through small windows that could only be accessed by ladders placed on the riverbed. Holy Communion was received every Sunday in the same manner, their whole lives imprisoned or cloistered, depending on your point of view. The bridge was eventually rebuilt and Le Murate transferred to a convent in 1424.
That's a lot to take in, isn't it? Said Evelyn.
And then the convent became a jail, which it still is, symbolic and slightly ironic. Kit stayed silent, thinking. Evelyn said,
We'll never know the inner life lived out within those walls, the what could have been. We have so much more freedom than those who went before, and you will have so much more than me.
Evelyn looked once more at her watch.
My dear child, I need to get a taxi. My train's at 5.
Shall we shake hands and say goodbye then? Said the kid.
Let's.
And Evelyn held out her hand.
Oh, here's another name for you. Artemisia Gentileschi. You'll like her, she said, full of rage.
Thank you, kind gatekeeper. It's been so much fun.
Till we meet again.
And she turned and walked away.
Evelyn!
Shouted Kid. Evelyn stopped.
Convent or marriage?
Oh, convent, said Evelyn.
Me too.
So long, Kid, said Evelyn.
And she threw her one last wave before heading towards a stationary taxicab.
So long, Evelyn, said Kid.
And she held the tube of paper to her eye and watched the taxi disappear from sight. Ulysses looked up from his week-old English newspaper when he heard the slap, slap, slap of Alice's unruly run across the stones. He watched her push past a group of tourists pointing to the parrot on top of the statue of Cosimo R. She was out of breath when she got to him. He pulled her to him and kissed her head. Hair smelt of sweat and sun. You okay? He said, and she nodded and sat down. The terrace was inching towards shade, and he handed her his sweater. She brought it to her nose as she always did. One day she wouldn't. For now he was hers and she was his. Michele came out and placed 2 beers on the table and asked about Cressy. Ulysses said he would be down in a minute. The kid picked up Ulysses' beer and brought it to her lips. She still didn't like it. She just wanted to grow up fast. She tore a piece of bread in half and ate ravenously. She wanted to leave school and beat up the boys who laughed at her. She wanted to speak Italian fluently and get a job and take a train like Evelyn and look back at countless miles of late nights and adventures. She couldn't imagine herself old, but she could imagine herself no longer young. She put down the glass and wiped her mouth. Ulysses was watching her as if he could see those thoughts. What you got there? He said. She held up the tube of paper and said,
I'm going to wait for Cressy before I show you. It's worth waiting for, she added.
Cressy calling out across the stones. Ulysses pulled out a chair for him, and Cressy reached for the beer before he sat down.
Fixed it, he said. Ah, Cressy, took me all afternoon, but...
The kid nudged him with her head. She was the one who'd found the old lever espresso machine in the flea market.
And what's this? Said Cressy,
tapping the paper tube on Alice's lap. She wouldn't show me till you came down, said Ulysses.
This,
she said, untying the string and rolling it out,
is me.
I didn't have to pay for it.
Cressy whistled.
Well, that is a beauty.
Ulysses frowned. D. Cunningham.
We'll have to get that framed, said Cressy,
and he took the portrait from her and carefully re-rolled it.
The Dorothy Cunningham. Said Ulysses.
I don't know if she's a the, but the signature's real, said Kid. A lady told me it was.
Dorothy Cunningham was here.
Over there in the colonnade.
What lady told you? Said Ulysses.
When I was in the church.
What church?
There's a mighty lot of questions going on here, said the kid,
pretending to drink Cress's beer. She wiped her mouth and said,
The church where the pink and blue painting is, the one we went into with Pete. I followed an old lady inside because she looked interesting. She was dressed all in white.
Maybe she was a nun, said Cress.
She had a white turban on her head.
Maybe not then, said Chris.
And I showed her my picture, and then she said she had to go because she had a date with Rome.
A date with Rome, said Cressy. Fancy that.
5 o'clock train. I told her I liked the cloud, and then Evelyn, that was her name, she said...
Ulysses was out of the chair before she could finish. Eat without me, he shouted as he ran across the square in the direction of the river. Along the Lungarno Guicciardini, people stopped to watch. He dodged cars and cyclists and came dangerously close to a tram on the Ponte alla Caraia. His lungs were bursting, his legs burning. Scusi, scusi, he shouted, through Piazza Goldoni and up Via dei Fossi, into Piazza Santa Maria Novella, crossing tramlines, dodging workers, people staring, shouting. I'm coming, Evelyn. I know it's you. He ran up to the railway station, 3 steps at a time, and bent double at the departure board, a right old dog pant. He saw the platform number and raced towards it. And people were shouting and gesticulating, and he's a liability in crowds. At the platform gate, he saw the train slowly moving off, and he begged to go through. And the train accelerated, and he was off again, and his legs were so tired. And he managed a last burst of speed, and he thought he might just get there, might just... But the platform ran out. And the train was gone. He sat down. A policeman stood over him as he tried to get his breath. On the train, Dotty had been watching events out of the window. When Evelyn returned to the carriage, Dotty said to her, I've just seen something extraordinary. A young man was running for the train as if his life depended on it. Love, said Evelyn. What else? Said Dotty. Evelyn leant across her friend to look out.
I don't see anything, she said.
Too late, said Dotty, and she sat back and unwrapped a mortadella sandwich. Bite?
No, thank you.
You look a bit forlorn, said Dotty.
I feel as if I've left something behind, said Evelyn. I feel a bit incomplete.
You'll be back.
Yes, I suppose I will.
But the knowledge of her future return didn't dispel the feelings of unease. She reached for the mortadella sandwich.
Maybe I will have a bite, she said.
Go on, tuck in, said Dotty. There's artichoke in it.
Delicious, said Evelyn. Lifts it, doesn't it? I meant to tell you, said Evelyn when she'd finished chewing. I met the young girl you drew.
Dotty laughed. Cap and dark fringe. Quite a character, said Evelyn. She rather charmed me.
But you don't like children, Dotty.
No, I know I don't. But she was more like an adult in small clothes. She said she ran a boarding house.
A boarding house?
Evelyn took another bite of the sandwich.
You signed it, Dotty, she said.
I know. But I had to. For the upkeep. Boarding houses don't come cheap, you know. A little under a year later, in January 1955, Evelyn planned another trip to Florence, but had to cancel on account of a nasty bout of flu. She lost days to her bed and was crotchety and frustrated. Jem Gunnerslake visited with flowers, and Evelyn was happy to see him. He confirmed that his mother was Penelope, the theatre critic. Why? He said.
No reason, said Evelyn, who couldn't wait to tell Dotty.
He stood in front of a photograph, a rare grouping of the three Vis, Virginia, Violet, and Vita. They looked miserable and interesting. Dotty was there that day. You can see her with a shotgun in the background, blurred but the stance unmistakably Dotty. Jem said, I'd like to see Miss Cunningham again. And Evelyn smiled and thought,
when she finds out who your mother is, you probably will.
That evening, Dotty came by to make soup.
This flu virus wouldn't have touched me if I'd been 45, said Evelyn.
That would have been the male strain, said Dotty. Evelyn laughed and then coughed. Dotty brought in the soup and confessed she had forgotten to put the bones in.
It's still very tasty, said Evelyn.
You must be ill, said Dotty. I wanted to show you this, said Dotty. And she unzipped her portfolio case and pulled out painting after painting.
The light, said Evelyn.
You, said Dotty.
Your take on the city.
And you, said Dotty. How could those men not have been successful back then, said Dotty. The city gave them everything, didn't it? The city was everything.
Oh, yes. Had Michelangelo been born in Bologna, it might all have been different, said Evelyn, suddenly on the mend.
In 1956, Evelyn did return to Florence, but this time without Dotty. She took the train down from Venice, a brief respite from the Biennale where her friend was showing the Florentine work. She spent a morning watching the reconstruction of the Santa Trinita Bridge, and from there her wanderings took her down a narrow street that led into Santo Spirito Square. The market was still in progress, and it was noisy and enchanting. She entered from the north side by the church. Couldn't have known that Ulysses was driving out from the south side with the kid, although the sight of a Jowett Bradford van did register somewhat. He was delivering a globe to a villa near San Gimignano. There had been no haggling over the price, and the price had remained high. It was one of his better globes. Evelyn ate an early lunch at Michele's, and from her table even noticed an old man and a parrot sitting with the elderly women on the stone benches, sharing vermouth. She cast no judgment at such a sight, because Santo Spirito had always been more outré than the other quarters. Why on earth didn't she stay over this side, she thought. Colleagues stayed in the Bandini above the German Institute of Art in the Palazzo Guadagni, but it had always been too male for her. So what, she thought. When she returned, maybe she'd try it. Her espresso was brought out to her by a large man in an apron. They conversed freely about the economic changes to the area, which were considerable. Had she only thought to ask his recommendation of a nearby and affordable pensione? She didn't, however. He brought her the bill, and she ambled back to the railway station. She took the last train to Venice and attended a party with Dotty at Peggy Guggenheim's. Peggy had a good eye. They talked about Jackson Pollock. Evelyn told her the best tin sardines to buy, and she was delighted. You're always welcome here, said Peggy. In 1958, Evelyn and Ulysses actually passed by one another on the Ponte Vecchio. They'd laugh about that later. Both were in conversation, Evelyn with a young art restorer, and Ulysses with Massimo. Evelyn's sight was downstream towards the Ponte Santa Trinita, which had been completed the previous year. Oh, happy day, she said, or words to that effect, even though the head of spring would remain missing for another 3 years. Rumour had it that it had been stolen, kidnapped, sold to an American billionaire. The Parker Pen Company even offered a reward of $3,000 to find it. What a palaver. A dredging crew would eventually find it on the riverbed. As for Ulysses and Massimo, they had stopped midway and were looking upstream towards the Casentino. Massimo was saying that the person he had recently fallen in love with was actually a man. He had his hands in his pockets and was waiting either to be pitted or to lose a precious friendship, because those had generally been the two outcomes of past confessions. "It'd better be good to you," was all that Ulysses said. They came off the bridge into an evening of Negronis and silliness. Relief, really. "Never worry about stuff like that with me," said Ulysses. He met the boyfriend 2 months later, an older American academic called Phil. Quiet, dependable, interesting. Everything you'd want in a man. Evelyn and Ulysses danced like this, and would dance like this for years. Only their thoughts kept time. An elegant two-step created from a jig at the side of a Tuscan road. He went to a gallery and thought of her. She saw a globe and thought of him. She went to a jazz club with Dotty and listened to a pianist who they thought might have been the frontier piano man from the West End play. Couldn't be, could it? He played a song he said he rarely played. Cress's song, he called it. And in December 1959, sitting in her Bloomsbury flat, Evelyn paused in front of her notebook. She was attempting to formulate an introduction to still life painting that would include the idea of female space, when she felt cold all of a sudden. She went over and put another log on the fire. She drew her cardigan tight around her shoulders and the orange button she'd got 5 years earlier in Sant'Ambrogio caught her eye. It was striking in its otherness, just like the memory of a 9-year-old girl who was sometimes called Alice and sometimes called Kid. Evelyn reached for her glass of claret and stood in front of the fire.
Some activities are exalted, others dismissed as lowly or humble or trivial, she thought. So who is it who decides? Privilege and male gaze, ultimately.
She refilled her glass and sat down.
Life of the spirit versus that of the physical, she wrote. Sacred versus the profane. The educated versus the not. A world where the outer and inner is in constant opposition. The world of the domestic kitchen is a female world.
She underlined this.
It is a world of routine, of body and of bodily function. A world of blood and carcass and guts and servitude. Men may enter, but they do not work there, and yet work is all that women do there. Occasionally, in such paintings, male items may appear on the table, pipes, watches, maps, often in the most ludicrous composition, and yet they succeed in what they intend to do, revoke the feminine space, male triumph over the triviality of the scene.
She drank from her glass. She continued to write.
The power of still life lies precisely in this triviality, because it is a world of reliability, of mutuality between objects that are there and people who are not. Paused time in ghostly absence. Who was it who prepared the food, who gutted the fish, who scrubbed the kitchen? These are the actions that maintain life. Objects representing ordinary life reside in this space. Plates, bowls, jars, pitchers, oyster knives. The shape of these objects has remained unchanged, as has their function. They have become fixed and unremarkable in this world of habit, and we have taken them for granted. Yet within these forms, something powerful is retained. Continuity, memory, family.
She put down her pen.
The child wouldn't be 9 anymore, would she? 14 at least. 14 with a new decade approaching. How wonderful.